and therefore, the whatever grant of arbitrability to the panels included in Article 19 did not apply for this particular dispute because of the exception in paragraph G.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Bailiff, if you would let us know when there are 5 minutes left and so forth, because we don't have a clock in front of us. I don't know if you
would. I don't have a clock in front of me.
Okay.
It says zero.
Right.
So sorry, I didn't notice that.
So in this particular case, the district court decided it. The district court should have decided it under FAA law. And the order, of course, shows that the district court passed on arbitrability. With regard to the question of whether the disputed issue was arbitrable, the district court error is clear error under Montana law and the FAA. It is clear error because the district court did not apply the law correctly and did not construe the agreement according to its plain language. Montana is a plain language jurisdiction. Its law applied in this case. And I have handed up, and I hope your honors have this, two handouts that I prepared for purposes of this argument. One is of Article 19, and the other one is of the district court order. Both documents contain highlighting to assist me with the argument. With regard to the first handout, which I hope you have, which is Article 19, the issue here is the construction and application of the exception to arbitration in paragraph G. That is found on page 6 of the handup or page 26 of the gathering agreement. That provision is written in very broad, plain, simple, unambiguous language. Under Montana law, it needs to be applied as written without further interpretation.
And so as long as you've called our attention to it, in subparagraph G, it starts with the words, any dispute.
Yes.
Dispute's not capitalized there, but I take it there's no dispute among the parties. That is, it's the defined term dispute that's elsewhere defined in this agreement, right?
I don't believe that there is a dispute as that. And okay. I would point, Your Honor, back to 19.1B, where actually the term dispute, at least in its first statement, does have a small d. So I believe that the word dispute as used in 19.1F and 19.1G are one and the same.
Even though the contract goes back and forth with capitalization occasionally. All right.
I believe that to be the case.
So then my question is, under 19G, it says any dispute which involves a counterclaim. I'm paraphrasing, right? How does a counterclaim, I ask you, how does a counterclaim become part of a dispute as defined in the agreement?
By pleading it and pleading a counterclaim that arises out of the same transactions and occurrences as the original claim, which is clearly what happened here.
That's exactly what happened. The dispute was pleaded, but the dispute was pleaded in court, not in the dispute mechanism that was provided for in this agreement, if I understand the position of SourceGas correctly.
SourceGas initiated a dispute. Bitter Creek's position is that its declaratory claim took it outside Article 19 through the operation of paragraph G. The dispute provision does not require a counterclaimant to issue a notice of dispute. It requires the original claimant to issue the notice of dispute, and that was done here.
If, cutting to the bottom line, under your position, any time one of the parties doesn't want to go to arbitration, all they have to do is file a counterclaim, or another claim, sounding in declaratory relief, and that ends the ability of the parties to arbitrate under this agreement. That's really what your position comes down to, isn't it?
That is the position, because that is the way 19F and 19G are written.
Why doesn't that analysis render basically render a nullification of this entire, of the entire arbitration process that's provided for in this contract then?
Well, for two reasons. The first is the parties can draft and agree to an arbitration agreement that's either broad or narrow. In this case, with the exception, I think you can say that the overall scope of arbitration could be very narrow. If somebody chooses to file a counterclaim or a claim for declaratory relief. Remember, this is a mutual provision. Source Gas could have easily taken its claims out of arbitration by joining to its damages claims a claim for injunction or declaratory judgment, which frequently happens in damages cases. The reason, Your Honor, it doesn't render it meaningless or surplusage is that that has to be done. In other words, 19F applies unless somebody asserts either a claim or a counterclaim for declaratory relief. That doesn't necessarily have to happen, and if it doesn't happen, indeed, if both parties decide they do want to arbitrate, well, 19F is effective. In other words, it has legal effect.
Essentially, this is an agreement that only mandates arbitration if both parties agree. If one party doesn't agree, it doesn't say that expressly, but that's the effect of this, all this mechanism, yes, according to your position. Okay.
Yes, I do. And I think the parties are perfectly capable of rendering an agreement like that. And it made perfect sense in this case for two reasons, at least two reasons. The first is this agreement went on for up to 99 years. It's a life of field agreement. It's in Article 2, I believe, of the gathering agreement. It doesn't surprise me that parties at the outset were not willing to bind themselves necessarily to arbitrate without an opt-out that they both had for the next 99 years. The second reason here is that we all know from arbitration cases that when there are claims that are arbitrable and claims that are not, one of the things that happens is claims get severed, they go to arbitration, other claims remain in a different jurisdiction. This agreement basically gave the party or parties the ability to put all of the claims in one forum. If you decided you didn't want to split forms by having some claims in one place and equitable claims in another, you assert your equitable claims, you can pull them all into court. And there's, again, nothing wrong with that. The order to arbitrate, I'd like to focus on just for a moment if I could. I've highlighted areas in here where I believe that the court clearly erred in this construction of the agreement. And there are essentially three areas here. The first is on page 4, and it's the purple highlighting at the top and the bottom of the page kind of represents what's going on here. The court concluded that the arbitration agreement required arbitration of all damages claims. That was clear error. Damages claims can be excluded from arbitration by the exception in 19G. The conclusion otherwise is error because the arbitration agreement nowhere provides for arbitration of all damages claims exclusively.
I'll go ahead, finish your thought, but I do want to move you on to a point because you're running a little low on time.
I am, and I was done with that point.
Okay. Let's assume for the purposes of this question that we would affirm the arbitrability. Given the state of the law, what statutory ground exists for vacating this arbitration award?
Well, it would be under Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act. And that has enumerated grounds for vacating the arbitration award. And also, as those grounds have been construed by federal court cases, and I agree that there is a split, at least one of the grounds includes a manifest disregard of the law, which occurred here for the reasons we set forth in the briefing. This was a panel made up of skilled practicing lawyers who clearly entered a damages award based on revenues, not on net profits, clearly awarded something far more than compensatory damages. And it was, they knew, because it was brought to their attention, that Montana law by statute didn't permit such awards, and they made one anyway. That is a manifest disregard of the law. That is also in excess of their powers under the contract, and it's a violation of public policy because Montana has a statute against such awards.
But let me ask you a question. Dr. Becker, the expert for the plaintiffs, apparently testified that the damages were in this neighborhood of $24 million for the Tier 1 losses, correct?
He did.
You did not, excuse me, your client did not put on any countervailing estimate or calculation, what do you call the incremental extra gas, incremental gas purchases because of the pressure differential, did you?
I don't believe that to be accurate. In cross-examination, it came out that it was an all gas volume measure of damage.
So you challenged his opinion, your client challenged his opinion in cross-examination.
It was.
The arbitrators ended up accepting his opinion, apparently, right?
Well, the arbitrators ended up saying that they couldn't determine what the incremental gas volume was, and because no incremental gas volume measure had been presented, they were going to use the all gas measure.
So although they call it a waiver, why isn't that just a failure of proof? And the arbitrators took the expert opinion that was before them, and they accepted that. Why was that a manifest disregard of the law, and why should we say that those aren't compensatory damages?
Because they're not compensatory damages. All the evidence points to that. But more importantly, what happened here is the panel decided the burden was on Bitter Creek to come forward with a reasonable estimate of the incremental measure. And that's not the law. The law is the plaintiff has the obligation to come forward with a reasonable estimate of compensatory damage. That did not happen. All practicing lawyers know that's the burden of the plaintiff. And this panel disregarded that law. With that, I'd like to save my last 50 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Mike Beatty. My registration number is 9629. With me today is Rebecca Naker, 14,845. And may I just say in passing, Judge Plank, I'm glad you're here since I'm at 9629. I have three topics I'd like to cover briefly if I could. One is the standard of review, which was discussed. The second is arbitrability, and I'd also like to deal with damages. First of all, the standard of review for an arbitration award we've already discussed is Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act. That means no review of the evidence, no review of the sufficiency of the evidence, no review of the merits. It's grudgingly narrow, highly deferential. Judicial review is characterized almost as a misnomer, and that is how you would deal with the issue, especially with regard to damages. Now, there is a slight difference with regard to arbitrability.
You know, I was going to ask you, do you agree with your counterpart that who decides the issue of arbitrability is the trial court in this case?
No, I don't agree with my with learned counsel for the other side, and let me explain to you the reason why. There are two questions. One is the arbitrability question itself, and the second is who is the proper person to decide, or the entity. Notice that here, both entities did decide arbitrability. I do agree that the standard with regard to who decides from the first options case in the United States Supreme Court is that there must be clear evidence that the arbitration panel is vested with that authority. And I believe that that clear evidence does exist, and I'll talk about why it does.
So what is it?
But once, if you decide the panel should decide, then the panel's decision, which was that it was arbitrable, is then reviewed under Section 10. can only overturn for extreme disregard.
Right, and I agree that's an important issue in this case, and so I would ask you what clear and unmistakable evidence there is that it was intended for the arbitration panel.
I know that this is a violation of my fundamental rule, but if I could just add one sentence before I answer your question. If the panel is to decide, the panel then does decide de novo, then the presumption of arbitrability comes into play, so that you have to look at it and say, there's no possible way I could read this to be arbitrable. And so that's what happens if you go down the court route. So either way, we believe that you end up in arbitration. But now then, let me explain to you specifically why I believe that there's clear evidence. If I could start just with the process and work you through, I'll start with B, which is directly responsive to your question. Subsection B defines a dispute and means any claim or controversy. But if you'll notice item number 3, it says it also includes interpretation of and application of the dispute resolution provision of this article. So that is specifically vested in the entity that is to decide the dispute. Now all we need to do is decide who is it, who's supposed to decide that dispute, because clearly that's within the ambit of their authority. You go to C and you look and it says, in the event of a dispute, the first thing that happens is that a party must deliver, this is the second sentence, Judge Roman, failure to deliver a dispute notice shall bar a party from asserting the existence of the dispute, and notice, Judge Richman, that's a small d right there, against the other party in any other form. If you don't give a dispute notice, you are forbidden from arguing the existence of a dispute in any other form. And the last time I looked, the Court of Appeals of Colorado is a form. So you start out with that process, you deliver a dispute notice. The second thing that happens is you'll have the senior executive negotiation. And I just call your attention to the last sentence of that provision, D. Notice it says all of these negotiations are going to be treated as compromise and settlement negotiations under the federal rules of evidence and the state rules of evidence. Why do I call your attention to that, Judge Roman? And the reason I do that is because it's clear that what's happening is as you go through the dispute process, it anticipates the possibility that it could go to an arbitration panel or it could go to a court. The reason I say that is in the arbitration rules, I'll use the AAA as an example, it's not mandatory that you follow the rules of evidence. So if they're saying this is going to be covered as a confidential negotiation under the rules of evidence, they contemplate that it's possible that you could go to litigation. And then you go to E, and E is where you split. And it says, if you haven't resolved the dispute then within 60 days, it will be resolved. Notice I'm reading right there at the end of that first sentence. It will be resolved either in accordance with F or paragraph G below. Notice what's critical here. G, litigation, is part and parcel of the dispute resolution process. And in either such case, whether you go to F or you go to G, you can't get punitive damages, you're going to be deciding the case under Montana law, and you're going to award reasonable fees. Now, notice that then you go to F and it says, except for a dispute identified in G below, a dispute will be settled by arbitration. The only dispute that someone can stand before this court and say exists in this case is the source gas dispute for damages, where they gave a dispute notice and triggered the process. Bear Creek refused to give a dispute notice. They refused to participate in the process. What they did is they jumped into a situation where they filed a lawsuit completely separate from the process and then said that explodes all of Article 19. All of Article 19 goes away. Judge Richmond, you asked the question of counsel, doesn't this make this really illusory, their interpretation? And indeed, that was acknowledged in the oral argument in the court below. This is from Bitter Creek's counsel. Source Gas's argument is that Bitter Creek's interpretation makes it illusory. Could the parties negotiate an illusory arbitration clause? You betcha. If that's what the parties intended, if they don't like arbitration, if one of them just doesn't like it and the other one really likes it, then they can sort of get this feel-good language in their agreement. But if one party sticks to its guns and says, unless I agree down the road to arbitration, you don't have an obligation, that's pretty close to what the parties did here. And then the judge turned and said, but aren't you reading out of existence almost all of the arbitration clause? And he referred to the dispute provision of B, where we started.
But let me ask you the reverse of what you're saying. If we were to agree with you on this point, wouldn't we be writing out Section G of the dispute resolution?
Not at all, Your Honor, not at all. Because G does have a role. G is part and parcel of the box, what I call the box, that describes the dispute resolution process. The dispute resolution process that was agreed to by the parties is you must initiate a dispute notice. You must give it. If you don't, you can't say there's a dispute anywhere. Then you go to negotiation. And then after you go to the negotiation, if that fails, then 60 days later, what you do is you will go to arbitration in all of the cases except where G would apply. Only except where G would apply. And G only would apply if there's an antitrust claim or injunctive relief.
So declaratory relief.
And Source, I appreciate you saying that to me. I do appreciate that because I want to talk about H as well. Notice that H is then the override paragraph that says, notwithstanding anything else, it's at the very end, H says, notwithstanding anything else, you could go get an injunction if somebody has suffered irreparable harm, but even if you do that, you still have to comply with the dispute resolution process. You must comply. In other words, you must trigger it with the dispute notice. And if you don't, you can never say that you've got a dispute.
Let me ask you about G then. G says any dispute which involves a counterclaim.
Yes.
When does the counterclaim come into play? When is the dispute measured? When in this line of events do you look? I mean, if the counterclaim came in the day after you filed your dispute, the dispute would involve a counterclaim, wouldn't it?
No, the counterclaim would be a separate dispute, Your Honor. The counterclaim would be a separate dispute. If what happened is I filed a dispute notice, and so I had a dispute, and I were the opposing party, and I believe, let me give you an example, that I had a counter to that to say, no, I didn't breach the agreement. You breached the agreement, and you violated the antitrust laws. Let's assume that was their claim. They would absolutely have the right to do that. That would then be a counterclaim, raising an antitrust claim with a dispute that they had triggered by delivery of a dispute notice. So it would work perfectly well.
You say you have to sever the two different cases, you end up one in the court and one in the arbitration?
I'm saying that there would have to be the two separate claims in that instance.
But it says any dispute which involves a counterclaim is an accepted dispute, defined term, and is outside all the provisions of Article 9. At least that's their position.
That's right. That is their position. I want to make certain that we go back to C, which says it says any dispute. G starts out with the language that says any dispute.
Okay,
so the only way that you can have a dispute is to deliver a dispute notice. The only entity in this case, and it's agreed, that delivered a dispute notice, the only entity that did, was Source Gas. Okay? Now, I've got 3 minutes. I would like, if I have an opportunity, to turn to the issue of damages, because I think that it's an essential part of this as well. Again, there is no question but that with regard to the standard of review, you must apply extreme deference. grudgingly narrow. And there is an additional standard, which if someone doesn't raise the issue below, the standard of review is nil. You can't appeal at all if you didn't raise it with the panel below. Here, the argument that the damages were punitive, that the damages exceeded the panel's authority, that the damages were based on a rejected theory of liability, that the damages were a windfall, that the damages were overstated by $21 million, I'm taking all of these arguments from their brief, that the damages were based on 6% of gas flow, or that the damages violate public policy, none of those arguments were raised below. None of them. Because they didn't dispute damages. They only disputed the issue of liability. In addition, there are two other points that are critical. The first is that in the briefing that you see before you, the appellants took the position that damages were awarded on a rejected theory of liability. That was the entire thrust of their appeal. In their first brief, as you read their brief, you will see, they're saying it was rejected by the panel. The panel rejected 8.4B liability. You know, the panel never had the question of 8.4B liability before. The breach that was alleged was 8.4A. And the only thing the panel did was to say this breach is so egregious, it could fall also into B. But we don't even need to get there because we find, and this is the finding, that the respondent pervasively and materially breached 8.4A. Second, and this is ignored throughout the entire briefing process, the damages were not, as appellant argues, just for somehow operating too much compression. It wasn't. It was certainly for that, but as well, it was also for the fact that they had negotiated with the producers behind our back in flagrant violation of the provision that said we were to be kept informed of any communications with the producer. And the other was that they couldn't install facilities unless we agreed that those facilities could be installed.
But the quantified damages weren't based on those breaches, were they?
Yes, they were. What happened is that, as the panel said, these violations proximately caused the damage. And then they said, the facilities and information damage and breaches are encompassed and subsumed within the amount sought in claimant's damage model does not seek separate additional recovery. What we did is that we totaled the entire recovery. Judge Richman, let me make this one point, just one point, which is if they couldn't have built the facilities, they couldn't have operated below 50 pounds, you'd never get to the incremental argument. I've run out of time. Thank you so much for your attention. I appreciate it very much.
So it says I have 4 to 6 seconds. I encourage the panel, I request the panel, to take a look at the second sentence in 19.1A, which reads, quote, except as provided in this Article 19, subparagraph 19.1G, neither party may commence an action in state or federal court. And it goes on. What that means is when Bitter Creek had its counterclaim and pled its counterclaim in state court, it was allowed to do that because that's a counterclaim for declaratory relief in 19G that it was entitled under Article 19 to bring in court. It takes that part of the dispute, and therefore the whole dispute, outside the four corners of Article 19. That means that arbitrability is decided by the court and not the panel, and that means that all the claims needed to be litigated, not arbitrated. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and we will enter an opinion in due course. Of course, going to